I'm Evelyn Strang from Texas Lutheran College. One of the things I teach there is geography, which sort of ties together all kinds of little bits of different disciplines. I don't know very much about economics the way Dan's specialty is, or geology, Rudy's specialty, or anybody else's specialty. I'm a generalist. But I guess our topic for this afternoon, in a way, is geographic, but I think it's also a Christian concern, namely, really global consciousness and our response in our lifestyle. Many of you have been in on some particular sessions that dealt with this, so at any one session we're always repeating some basics for someone, and we're picking up new people who are just coming into this kind of thinking. So I'll try to summarize some of the things that have gone before to see where we are and where we start from. I think at a retreat center like this, we away from responsibilities at home, where we have been all tied up in local situations and where maybe we need to be. At a center like this, we begin to meet other people, and we certainly have been reminded here that our neighborhood is the world. And I think these past weeks with the Paul Wees presence and other people who have lifted our consciousness beyond ourselves, our own community and so on and so forth, we recognize that our neighborhood is the world, and that the mission of the church, and we're not just talking about the Lutheran church, the mission of the church is global. This is Christmas Eve in the village. If we're to take a God's eye view, we recognize that God so loved the world. And we start in our own community, but we look beyond. And so we have had our consciousness raised. Some of you have been here long enough to have heard about Namibia, which maybe you never heard about before. We have an international perspective, people who've lived in other parts of the world and so on, so that we do have that opportunity for growth. Another thing that's certainly come to our consciousness is that in the world community, even in the household of faith, there are many who are not eating very well, or maybe not eating at all, living under conditions that would appall us. And even if you are a pretty sophisticated world traveler, you recognize that a lot of people who travel to other parts of the world never really see this. In other words, you can go to Rio and see the beautiful beaches and all of this and never really see the favelas, the slums, because they're not on the city tours. Sometimes the poverty in other parts of the world does not really come to our consciousness until somebody really raises the issue before us. We're being reminded by our Christian friends in the third world that one of the barriers that's separating people is not just that of male, female, and we're working through that, Jew, Greek, but of poor, rich, which I guess is another form of slave, free. And that the barriers between the rich and the poor seem to be getting wider. I mean, the barriers seem to be getting higher. The gap seems to be getting wider. The problems are so overwhelming and so complex that it would be very tempting for us to retreat into a personal religion that focuses on our inner life. We could bask on God's love as we have experienced it. We can praise the Lord for what He's done in our own lives. And it would be very easy to leave it there, because the problems beyond us are so complex that we just sort of retreat from them. Yet Jesus' life always showed that balance between the inner and the outer. A retreat, maybe, up on the mountaintop someplace to pray alone. But He always returned to the multitudes and their problems. And I think this is our opportunity at Holden, that we can grow in our inner life, our meditation. And there are times to be alone by the creek or something, if you're not too afraid of the bear, if you're by yourself or whatever, a time to be alone. But always we need to consider the world out there, not only here, which is really not the real world, but the real world to which we're returning. All right, I think that some new things are happening in our generation among Christian people, even Lutherans, that is exciting. I've seen it happen in my own life, I guess. And that, I would say, is a growing social consciousness about our global relationships. Now, as a child, I was aware, made aware by my own family's example, that a Christian feeds the hungry And I remember the Depression years when there would be the tramps coming to the door, and my mother always managed to find something, a sandwich or something. It wasn't much, but she managed to find something. And I guess most of us have grown up in gathering clothing. Since World War II, there's hardly at least a Lutheran congregation or others also that has not been urged to collect clothing for Lutheran World Relief. And we've been happy to share our abundance from our clothes closets or whatever. We've been willing to help the poor, to bring them things or send them things in the name of Christ. That's nothing new. But I think the next stage of consciousness has happened. At least it's happened to me. And from what I read, I see it happening to other people. I'm reminded of a story from Dick Gregory's autobiography. Some of you have read it. Where this poor black family in the ghetto, was it in St. Louis, I think, where he grew up, some well-meaning church people brought the family for Thanksgiving or Christmas, probably Thanksgiving, this big frozen turkey and left it and felt so good about that, helped this poor family. And never checked to see, to realize, that the family's utilities had been turned off because they couldn't afford to pay the bill. And so what were they going to do with a frozen turkey, you see? And I think our next stage of social consciousness, global consciousness, and so on, is realizing you don't only think of, from your affluence, what you can hand out to other people, you know, very benevolently and in good faith, but maybe to take another look at the situation in which the people are finding themselves. And to try to understand the situation. And I think that's a new level of consciousness. Work ethic that some of us grew up with says, and I've heard it said by people, if they would just work the way my family did. My family came over to this country with nothing. They were the poorest of the poor. They worked hard and they made it. Have you heard that? Mm-hmm. I've called it the German work ethic. I mean, it's been called the Protestant, but I mean ethnic. I've heard it called the German work ethic. I was in a group of some Swedish friends who identified it as Swedish. Any Norwegians here who want to claim it also as Norwegian may do so, anything like that. But anyway, the feeling, again, the judgmental feeling of we made it because we worked, if they just get out there and work, they could make it, and so on and so forth. That has been part of what some of us have grown up with. Now, this week you've had a good opportunity to discuss some of the causes of poverty. I think Jan has led you into some very challenging thinking about that, to recognize, for example, one thing, that some people don't work hard because they're too hungry and they're malnourished. I know that was discussed here. That when you aren't well fed, you don't feel like working. You don't have the vitality or health. And that is not only true in other countries, but in this country also. And another issue that has been brought up is the idea of overpopulation. And I have heard it said in discussions in World Hunger in my own congregation, this judgmental thing, looking down at other people. If they just quit having so many kids, they wouldn't have any problems. And that was said by a well-educated man in my congregation, in fact, a doctor in the community. Putting the blame on them and judging them for having too many kids. All right, from the geographic viewpoint and a lot of other viewpoints and so on and so forth, some people are saying, and we quoted that this morning, that it is not so much that it's a problem of overpopulation causing poverty, but poverty may breed overpopulation in situations, and that's another whole story. But in the demographic transition, the thing that has happened is that people are not madly having more children than they did before. But there was a time when they had to have large families to work the farm, and so that enough would live to survive, and also to provide social security for parents in countries where there is nothing of that kind of thing guaranteed. So that when modern medicine comes in, when more children live, it is not that they're having more children, but more of them are living. And so we are caught in that gap, the demographic transition. After a while, statistics show studies of developed countries and so on, after a while that levels off and people begin to realize they don't need all those children to make it or to survive. There are other factors that enter in. But I think it's important to try to understand the situation instead of sort of to say, well, if they just do this. I think another thing is that understanding the history of countries. U.S. education, as I see it, is woefully deficient in teaching about the other parts of the world. How many of you have had a good course in Latin American history? History of the Soviet Union? Far Eastern history? Anywhere, a few of you have. That's very, very rare. And so our students go through high school and they may get through college without really knowing very much about the historical setting, the political and economic background of the countries with which we deal. We're ignorant. Some of the people we send to represent us in other parts of the world are almost as ignorant, but that's another story. So anyway, for example, the whole business of, well, Latin America is different from Southeast Asia. Jan has used his illustrations mainly from Southeast Asia, from Latin America. I mean, the whole way things developed historically. The conquistadors who came in there, I mean, came out of almost a feudal system in Spain and Portugal for Brazil, that a few people had the large estates, the big haciendas, and so on and so forth. And that pattern still persists, that a very high percent of the land is in the hands of a very few people. Now, our history did not develop in the same way at all. So we cannot judge, let's say, Latin America by our standards, because their history is different. Their economic development was different, where they were somebody else's colony and where they were set either to provide mineral wealth or maybe agricultural produce to the mother country or whatever. And then I think we need to recognize the geographic factors. I wouldn't know of another natural environment setting that appears to have such great possibilities as does this one, which we call the United States, in terms of having important minerals, let's say for steel production or something like that, easily connected, as far as without having to go across tremendous mountains or across great barriers, to bring the factors for industry together, to have rich arable land, to have an ocean on each side, that in the early development there didn't have to be a lot for defense. You weren't threatened from the outside. I mean, there's so many factors in our history that are different from other history. So I think the other point that about this, that it's so easy to judge other countries on the basis of what we have done. I don't think we dare to do that unless we are well acquainted with their historical situation, their geographic setting, whatever the thing is, and it's very easy to do that. I think another thing that's happening in a new consciousness is that our affluence and our prosperity here is somehow tied in to poverty in other parts of the world. Now, I'm not saying it's our fault that other people are poor in Colombia or Mexico. I haven't said that. And neither am I saying that we can solve the problem. I don't think we can. But I do believe we need to recognize that we're tied in with all of humanity. Rudy could tell you that from the ecological awareness. I think the whole ecology movement first raised our consciousness, hey, we're tied in with the rest of the world. I mean, if China does some nuclear testing out there above ground, some of that fallout may be carried out in winds and so on and so forth that fall over the United States. So we get pretty excited about that. And if there's some big oil slicks, even if somebody else's ship or someplace else, it may hit our beaches or some perfectly innocent bystander country, you know, that just happened to be in the way of where the ship sprang the leak or something like that. So we're recognizing more and more that the whole natural environment is sort of tied together. In Joe Sittler's words, something like it's, he likened it to a spider web. You touch one part of the spider web and the whole thing quivers. So Rudy can be much more profound on the idea of how everything is tied together in the natural world. I think we've recognized that first. Well, I think we're just beginning to realize that everything is tied together in the world economically, in economics, in the political sense, and so on, more than we ever before. certainly the whole business about the oil crisis. This morning the point was made that particularly our kind of society, the capitalistic society that draws a lot of materials that it does not produce from elsewhere, our way of life in this area depends very, very much on the rest of the world. And when something interrupts the flow of important goods or raises the price drastically, we get pretty shook up. Some of us remember from World War II what happened with rubber, natural rubber being cut off, and of course we always think about our ingenuity. Okay, you produce synthetic rubber, so we're about going about it the same way. We're tied up. But we realize that we're never really we're never really independent. So we know that from our angle. We know we need produce from other parts of the world. And it's neat, you know, you can trace where all the things you come from, where all the things you use in daily life. If you really track some of those down, it's amazing how far spread they are. Finally, I bought a little cheap little calculator, Texas Instruments, which should be Dallas, but it's put together in Costa Rica. Interesting little things like that. Now, you look at where stuff is made, fine print. That's a new development, by the way. I didn't know that was happening. We have never really looked at what happened or what the situation might be in the countries at the sending end or from which we buy the stuff. So we've looked at us and say, yeah, we depend on them. And we sort of expect them to serve us, and we get a little upset when they, you know, raise the price or them. But we've never quite looked at the effect. One of the things that's happened in the churches, and I think that's exciting, is, for example, a whole Nestle bit and the baby food formula. Now, I won't run that by again because I think most of you are acquainted with it. If you're not acquainted with it, talk to me about it or somebody else who's knowledgeable. But I think for the first time we begin to recognize that maybe our habits as consumers in buying products or not buying products produced by a certain corporation, which is one of the multinationals, may affect the policies of that country, of that company. At least that's what the whole baby food Nestle thing was saying. How many of you do know about the Nestle thing? All right, that's most of you. All right. That's a new consciousness in the church that I think is exciting. Now, boycotting Nestle, and, you know, they are the best chocolate chips. So it's a little hard to make your favorite chocolate chip cookies without the Nestle, but I do. Anyway, I mean, without Nestle or something like that. It may not make much difference, but it is a consciousness that what the consumers, the wealthy countries do, does affect what happens in the poor countries, and that we're tied in with the whole thing. I'll give you my banana illustration. When I went to Hawaii in January with a group of students from TLC, before I left, I noticed that the price of bananas in Seguin, where I live, was 25 cents a pound. It fluctuates, 25, 29, something like that. In Hawaii, on the island where the bananas grow, they were 39 cents a pound. Now, why should they be so much more expensive where they were grown? Hawaii is a state. You need to pay minimum wage for agricultural labor. So it reflects more of an honest price for production of bananas in that environment. They're much cheaper in Seguin, and I don't know what they were in January where you live, because we're getting them at cheap labor in the banana republics, again Costa Rica and so on. People there get very low wages. The bananas are produced there. They can be shipped in all the way not only to Texas but to Washington State or wherever. And the price is still lower than if they could be produced domestically. Now, you might say, well, it employs a lot of people there. Yes, but that's not the whole story. The other part is that three U.S. companies control 90% of the banana industry production in those countries. So here is a multinational with mainly capital from the United States, or three multinationals and so on, really calling the shots in some of the little countries as far as who's working and what will be produced. There's all kinds of documentation on that. Bread for the World did a beautiful one. If you get the mailing from Bread for the World, they had an excellent illustration of how all of this works and how it affects an individual life. in one of their recent mailouts, the April one, and I have that in my files if you're interested. There are all kinds of illustrations. Let me give you another one you may not have read about. This one is from Peru. And in Peru and Bolivia, these are two countries where there's probably more canned and powdered milk used than fresh milk. Now, Peru could have dairy cattle, and they do. But the government policy has been to encourage the production of canned and powdered milk. The local company there, Leche Gloria S.A., which is the Peruvian, the big milk cooperative, and so on and so forth, the government policy is to support Leche Gloria, which is the distributor of the canned and powdered milk. Now, the point is that most of the ingredients for the cans, in fact, the cans, materials for the cans are shipped in from the outside. So that's going to add to the cost. And a lot of powdered milk is being shipped in from the outside, or the ingredients for the canned milk. Rather than the government encouraging production within Peru, the government seems to go along with the big corporation, which has a lot of influence, and encourage canned milk. By the way, the name behind that is Carnation, behind Leche Gloria. So here's one of the illustrations where a multinational corporation, in this case U.S.-based with a different name in Latin America, is in cahoots with the authorities, and the policies seem to favor the corporation. I mean, shipping in cans in a poor country. And the cost of milk has risen astronomically. I have some figures on that, whatever it is now. And the poor, well, the children are simply getting less milk. So there is case after case which is being documented. One of the best documentations of that, I didn't bring it with me because it's a big fat book, but some of you may know Barnett and Melder's Global Reach. Did you refer to that? Mm-hmm. Also, do you have your copy with you?
No.
Any place. I don't think it's in the library, but I mean, if you're interested in that, Barnett and Melder's Global Reach, which shows this kind of thing, how the workings of a multinational corporation may make a big difference in the lives of the people of that country, and in some cases the effect is to make the people there worse off than they were before. I think that can be documented again and again. All right, now that's a new economic awareness. Those of you who read Sojourners or The Other Side or some of the books like this have read all kinds of illustrations like this. But that's something I didn't realize, folks, till 10 years ago or so, or 5 years ago. Did you? And that's a new thing in my life. I mean, it's been going on for years. And it's not all U.S. corporations. I mean, Nestle is Swiss and there's some others. I mean, it's not all. Now, it's very easy to blame all the big corporations and say, I mean, undoubtedly some of them go in there with some good intentions of helping the people and so on and so forth. And it's not all, you know, it's not all bad. But there is enough evidence also that very often the situation is made worse for some people. Well, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. So we are connected with the rest of the world, whether or not we realize it, and I think we're beginning to have some evidence of that. Another exciting thing I think that is happening is that this social consciousness or this social awareness very often is on the biblical basis that the evangelicals, again, you know, Sojourner people and so on and so forth, are seeing parts of Scripture come alive about justice and so on that before were there, you know, you read it and it never hit you till all of a sudden. I mean, liberation theology, I think, has done some of that for us and so on. And we have a recognition that we have something to learn from the third world, from the poor. As a teacher, I'm learning more and more that it is not me as a fountain of all authority talking down to my students. I mean, you know, you have to learn that as a teacher, that you have so much to learn from your students. I've been blessed this year with three fine African students, for example, from different countries. Two of them are Lutheran pastors. I have learned so much from them, more than I could teach them in many ways, as I've had a chance to visit with them and so on and so forth. And this, of course, is what Paulo Freire is saying, pedagogy of the oppressed and so on, that we who have the better education sometimes in going into the third world, fourth world, fifth world, however many you wanted, to people who do not have the advantage of education. We have come as the fountains of all knowledge, and we were going to teach them how to do it. Well, there have been a lot of mistakes made in agriculture as people from mid-latitudes try to go to low-latitudes and try to show people in Brazil and the tropics how to farm the way you do in Iowa. It just doesn't work. I mean, there are all kinds of illustrations of where you cannot just automatically come in and, you know, there is much to learn from the people there. And I think another exciting thing that's happened in terms of a new stage of social consciousness, global consciousness, is that we don't have all the knowledge and the insight. We may have much to learn, maybe not in technology, but maybe in something about care for family, about just some understandings, about patience, or insight into human beings or something. We have much to learn. And so I think the newer attitude is working with our brothers and sisters in partnership. This has happened to the church in its mission program. We're working with our brothers and sisters. We have some things, but unless they want those things from us, we cannot impose them on. Have you learned anything from people in Colombia?
Yeah, a great deal.
Okay, right. I reached that stage of consciousness that you don't help people from a lofty position. I learned that about 20 years ago in my own hometown. I was a PTA president, and one of my goals was to involve the minorities in the PTA, because at that time they weren't too involved. And I did get some, committee chairpersons and so on and so forth, Mexican-American people particularly, and I felt real good about that, and boy, we were getting them involved and whatnot. And after one meeting, I was taking one of the women with whom I'd gotten to be friends, taking her home, because she didn't have a ride home in my car, which was fine. And we were discussing a coming election. Now at that time, Texas still had this abominable thing called a poll tax, where you didn't vote, believe it or not, we had that, where you didn't vote unless you also paid, you know, a certain amount of money. Like, oh, it was only about $2 or $3, or was it $5? I'm not sure, but I don't know if anybody else had that uncivilized thing, but Texas had a poll tax anyway at that time. And we were talking about the coming election, and this woman was bemoaning the fact that, she wouldn't be able to vote because they hadn't been able to afford to pay the poll tax. And that, of course, hit me. And so I reached into my bill fold and gave her money for the poll tax. And the minute I did it, I knew it was the wrong thing. Because, you see, I was from a superior position, giving her something, making her dependent. And I don't know why. It was the strangest feeling. It was a moment of insight. It was the wrong thing to do, for the right reason, maybe. A better approach, I think, would have been to try to understand and really get in there and work against the poll tax. I mean, to identify, to try to see her situation. What can we do to get rid of this poll tax? Well, we're rid of it because of some people who had more sensitivity than I did. But you see, this is one thing I've had learned and I'm still learning. I learned that you reach out and help the poor. You hand it to them, see? But I'm trying to learn how you work in a situation with people. And I have a long way to go on that. But I think this is where I'm being led. So how do we handle all of this? By the way, that's a new concept of stewardship. One of the books, I think it's in the bookstore here, Eric Walther in the Earth is the Lord, says this about stewardship. Now, we've usually thought about stewardship, you know, of all that we have, and we're sort of giving. Stewardship requires a concept of group. It is a lifestyle for the common good and requires some self-denial of individualistic greed. Stewardship means we limit our individual greed so that others, including people still unborn, can share in limited resources. There's a strong future orientation to stewardship, in contrast to the aspect of greed that emphasizes now. Stewardship requiring the concept of group, that's a new idea for me. See, I've always thought it as primarily an individual. But that means you're working with people and you're not just handing out kind of thing. And so the big question, of course, is with these new kinds of consciousness, the consciousness that some aspects of justice are involved in here, that poverty often is a result of somebody's greed, of economic systems and so on and so forth. How do you handle that? How do you respond? I think there are two responses. And one of them has to be the simpler lifestyle, and the other one has to be some kind of political activity. And how far you go with either is, I guess, a matter of how you feel about your personal response and how you take it. In the Corinthian community, we studied Corinthians earlier, there was something about how the Christian community was really broken when those who had more food ate in a corner by themselves, you know. Community that we talk about here is shattered when some have much more than others. And that's got to make us a little uncomfortable. And just because, you know, maybe I was told, and so were you, clean your plate, think of all the poor people in the world. And if you, you know, even if you didn't eat it, how would you get it to those people? You know, I mean, the transport of it. I mean, the idea is great. The application of it is pretty difficult. But I think the awareness that some in the community and the world community don't have very much may force us to examine our overconsumption. 2 years ago, when I came to Holden, I came by way of Alaska because, well, once I go to, I can always rationalize stuff. See, I mean, from where I live, once you're to Seattle, you're more than halfway to Alaska. So that was a year to go to Alaska. And I had planned to come back on the Alaska ferry. I mean, I really did it very economically and real proud of myself. And the Alaska ferry is pretty economical, and I wanted to see the inside passage and the glaciers and all this kind of thing. Well, the Alaska ferry was on strike, and so it was either fly home and miss all of that or book a cruise ship. I'd never been on a cruise. I decided, well, I want to see Glacier Bay and rationalize it, very geologic. So I got on a cruise ship, which was French registry, French cuisine. And for 5 days, I ate like I've never eaten in my life. I mean, French cuisine. I mean, they would, oh, I mean, at least 2 wines at every meal, 3. I mean, and you know, it's all prepaid. So, I mean, it's there and all this stuff. I mean, you know, anyway. So by the end of the week, you know, your eyeballs were bulging, but you think, well, I paid for it. I mean, cruise ship. You know, yeah, it's all kind of thing. I mean, I hadn't planned that, but I fell into it. Then I came to Holden, and Chalet 1, it may still be in that room, was a little sign that said, to feast every day is not to feast. And I really understood that after 5 days on a cruise ship. To feast every day is not to feast. You don't really appreciate feasting and the celebration of food if you eat high on the hog every day. I think that's what eating at Holden is trying to teach us. That we eat simply, and once in a while we celebrate. And you appreciate the celebration more because you don't eat like that every day. Now, in our lifestyle in this country, and I see it from college students who always gripe, but do you know of a college campus where students don't gripe about cafeteria food? Anybody? I mean, they always do. And if you're realistic about it, I mean, it's very edible. But, you know, some of the poor freaks are used to steak every day, or so they pretend, or something like that. If they don't have steak every day, or bacon and eggs every day, or something like that, I mean, they're deprived. And we've taken feasting every day almost as a right. And people get very upset when you talk about cutting down or something like that. I think our system has been geared to creating wants and not satisfying needs. And you think about our consumer system, I mean, beyond food and things like this, that nobody was born needing television. Now, television is fine. I mean, once you've got it.
Some things are sacred, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All righty. Or well, CBs, that can hit somebody else. You see, I don't have one, so that's an easy one to say. You know, nobody's born needing a CB. Now, they seem to be a nice toy for grown men to play with sometimes. I have a son-in-law who has more fun with his, and he's a sweet guy. Anyway, I realize, you know, out on the road they can be useful. But, I mean, the things that they weren't invented a few years ago. They were not really developed in response to a need. See, the desire for them was created.
Everyone, you know, the difference between men and boys is simply the price of their toys.
All right. Very good. Very good. Last year's biggest seller of four games for all ages, men and boys, I think was the electronic games that plug into the television.
Yeah.
You know that? Now, nobody needs that. Nobody in the world needs that to exist or to be happier. But it was the hottest selling item last year in the U.S. for Christmas. And those aren't cheap, are they? I don't know. I never even priced them. I mean, but they aren't cheap.
$100.
Yeah. And another thing is the instant replay thing. Now, that's also been a very big seller, you know, the instant replay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, about 500.
Yeah, and I mean, they're really selling. Now, you don't need those. All right, our system is saying, you know, that to live well, you've got to eat, you know, feast every day. You've got to have these things and so on and so forth. All right, I think here is where the Christian response has to just laugh at some of that. Were any of you in John's discussion group on Enough is Enough last week? All right, if you don't know John Lee Taylor's book, Enough is Enough, that's one of the classic. It lends itself very well to group discussions in the congregation, whatever. There are study guides available for this. John Lee Taylor, who is a bishop Winchester Cathedral, right, Winchester in England, is pointing out that, you know, the whole consumer bit, I mean, seeing it from a British viewpoint, but it just fits in here. I mean, that he's urging a joyful consumer resistance movement, that when we hear these ads, you know, you must have this and so on, you really ask, whom are you kidding? I mean, that kind of question. Now, that from the viewpoint of business people, I said this once in a class, and I had a student who was a business major call me on it and say, but that's bad for the American economy. You see, if you're not buying, the American economy is built on producing. But why don't we ever ask, producing what, you see? Are we producing for greed or for wants that have to be cultivated, or are we producing the basic necessities? And what is our system, Jan, producing more and more things we don't need and selling them elsewhere?
Well, it depends on how you perceive needs and...
And needs and wants. You see, what do you need? Yeah. You see, what do you really need? So that idea. All right. So there is all kinds of help, I think, for consciousness raising. Enough is Enough is one of the ones that's really been helpful. This also is in the bookstore. It's out of the Quaker community in San Francisco. Any of you know this? Taking Charge, How You Live Can Make a Difference, Practical Suggestions. It's a very, very useful book. John and Mary's book on things that make for peace. How many of you have been involved in some lifestyle group, some way or the other, simplifying lifestyle? All right, what we're talking about is cutting down our consumption, our overconsumption, and recognizing what is really essential. What would we really keep if we knew that our having it would deprive someone else of having it? One of the very fine articles that came out of a secular magazine, of all things, of Time, of June 4th, is a Time essay of June 4th. If you don't have that in your files, or if you haven't read it, it's worth looking up. The Weakness That Starts at Home. That's one John referred to. John,
what was it?
The Weakness That Starts at Home. And the secular writer here, this is not a church publication, Lance Morrow wrote the Time essay. And it's talking about our overconsumption, our thinking we've got to have all of these things. And we get all shook up when the price of oil goes up and we might have to do without oil. And he points this out as a national weakness, as a weakness. that starts at home. It's a very good essay that is really making a statement that sounds almost like a biblical prophecy or something like that. All right, one of the best summaries I've heard for choosing a simpler lifestyle was produced by Jürgen Lissner, Secretary for Peace, Justice, and Human Rights of the Lutheran World Federation. He gives 10 reasons why today's global realities call for comfortable Christians, that's us, to review their lifestyle. And he says you cannot lay down rules, they have to be developed by individuals. A simpler lifestyle is not a panacea. It may not cure anything necessarily. It may be embarked upon for the wrong reason. You can feel so guilty, those poor people in Namibia, I'm going to sacrifice, which may not do anybody any good. It may be a substitute for political action, but whatever. He says you can simplify your lifestyle for the wrong reason. But he lists 10. I won't cite all of them, but there's some of them. As an act of faith performed for the sake of personal integrity and as an expression of a personal commitment to a more equitable distribution of the world's resources. If you think of the global community and what other people don't have, you've got to be a little bit uncomfortable with overconsumption one way or the other as an act of faith. He says, as an act of self-defense against the mind and body polluting effects of overconsumption. I mean, that's mind and body polluting, to think you've got to have it. Or just the overeating, whatever it is, overbuying. Just self-defense. As an act of withdrawal from the achievement neurosis of our high-pressure materialist societies. I know all kinds of young families, also in my church, who are caught in financial binds because the little house they had, well, you know, it's all right. But I mean, everybody's moving out to this neighborhood, Townwood East. And there the houses are bigger. And the streets are wider, nice cul-de-sacs. And so young families will get into financial binds, into pressure, because they're moving up to a better house. When the house they had wasn't that bad, but the pressure, you see, moving up, feeling it, that kind of thing. As an act of solidarity with the majority of humankind, which has no choice about lifestyle. As an act of celebration of riches found in creativity, spirituality, and community with others, rather than in mindless materialism. A simpler lifestyle doesn't mean monasticism or something. It can be celebration of new, simpler things. Again, John and Mary's West Virginia thing. Not everyone can go to a farm in West Virginia. There is no way everyone can do that. There are different ways of being creative about simplifying lifestyle. I don't have a dryer. I have a solar dryer, a clothesline in my backyard. But I have a backyard. So I cannot automatically assume that everybody else ought to simplify lifestyle by not having a dryer. What are all the people in the city apartments going to do, you see? So each person's approach to this is going to depend on the situation in which he or she finds himself. Lissner also suggests one of the other reasons, an act of provocation to arouse curiosity, leading to dialogue with others about affluence, alienation, poverty, and social injustice. If you keep driving your old car till it's a clunker or something like that, people are going to begin to ask you, hey, why are you holding on to that or something? There comes a time, I mean, I really, 10 years I held my 10 years, and people were beginning to look at it, and I was making a point. Well, I finally gave in, you know, there's a point. But sometimes it can be an act of provocation to sort of, you know, I don't have to have this. I'm making a point. I don't need this. Listener also says, an exercise of purchasing power to redirect production away from satisfaction of artificially created wants. After all, you know, the system is geared around what people buy. If we say, hey, this is simply not necessary, this is ridiculous, it's wasting resources, it's wasting good resources, you know, it's just ridiculous, I don't need it. That does vote in what's happening if enough people do that, and so on. All right. We won't solve anything necessarily by our own simplified lifestyle. We won't solve the world's problems by that. But we're getting a little closer to feeling with the situation, and so on. And then the other aspect, the idea of political action. One of my favorite book on all of this, and it's the bookstore is out of it, but Ron Sider is coming to the Village middle of August, and I'm very sorry to miss him. And nobody here has met him, to my knowledge, but he's coming. Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, to me, is the most helpful book to put it all together, because he has a biblical basis, all of it concerned for social justice and so on and so forth. And I like this story that he uses that I've quoted in a number of speeches and so on and so forth. And this is a rationale, I think, for action. Siders, chapter 9. A group of devout Christians once lived in a small village at the foot of a mountain. A winding, slippery road with a hairpin curve and steep precipices without guardrails wound its way up one side of the mountain and down the other. There were frequent fatal accidents. Deeply saddened by the injured people who were pulled from the wrecked cars, the Christians in the village's three churches decided to act. They pooled their resources and purchased an ambulance so that they could rush the injured to the hospital in the next town. Week after week, church volunteers gave faithfully, even sacrificially, of their time to operate the ambulance 24 hours a day. They saved many lives, although some victims remained crippled for life. Then one day a visitor came to town. Puzzled, he asked why they did not close the road over the mountain and build a tunnel instead. Startled at first, the ambulance volunteers quickly pointed out that this approach, although technically quite possible, was not realistic or advisable. After all, the narrow mountain road had been there for a long time. Besides, the mayor would bitterly oppose the idea. He owned a large restaurant and service station halfway up the mountain. The visitor was shocked that the mayor's economic interests mattered more to these Christians than the many human casualties. Somewhat hesitantly, he suggested that perhaps the churches ought to speak to the mayor. After all, he was an elder in the oldest church in town. Perhaps they should even elect a different mayor if he proved stubborn or unconcerned. Now the Christians were shocked. With rising indignation and righteous conviction, they informed the young radical that the church dare not become involved in politics. The church is called to preach the gospel and give a cup of cold water. Its mission is not to dabble in worldly things like social and political structures. Perplexed and bitter, the visitor left. As he wandered out of the village, one question churned round and round in his muddled mind. Is it really more spiritual, he wondered, to operate the ambulances which pick up the bloody victims of destructive social structures than to try to change the structures themselves? So that gets into politics, political action. Again, you don't solve all the problems, but I think it's a new stage of global consciousness. On a local level, it may be something as simple as what's happening in land use policies. Is there a new shopping center going out over prime agricultural land outside town? Are there any hearings about that kind of thing? Or do you happen to be the only person who turns up at the hearing on that kind of thing, as I was, to say, well, now look, you're paving over good agricultural land, looking for the future? Maybe it's food stamp policies. There are hunger task forces now throughout churches. Maybe there's some things like that that can be done on a local or a regional level. On a global scale, it's much more complicated. It's terribly difficult to be informed on issues. It's very, very difficult. If you're a shareholder, something like that, a consumer, you may have a little bit to say in terms of the multinationals. We've talked about letter writing to those in political power. Bread for the World, how many of you are members? You know about, if not, oh my, there's a big field here. You can be informed on specific issues. Do you know the Impact Network? Both the LCA, ALC, for example, commend this. It's information lobbying, actually, on specific issues. There are networks of people with Christian concern. I'm just mentioning specifically Bread for the World and Impact, on which you can get on mailing lists, where you can be informed about certain causes. I think it's dangerous to write letters when you don't know what you're writing about. That's why any specific information we have this week, for example, about Namibia, Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, whatever, and so on and so forth. But I think it's important to recognize that we talk about being a democracy influencing the government. Maybe that's optimistic. Sometimes our government has helped the forces of oppression. I'll say that without fear of contradiction. I mean, you may contradict, but I think in document. What we did in Chile, our involvement in Nicaragua, supporting the Somoza regime until finally we let go of Somoza. I mean, those were not help. Those actions of our government were not helping human rights. They were not helping the majority of the poor people. So we love our country, but our country's policies have sometimes made the situation in the world elsewhere worse. And so as citizens, we have some responsibility there. Do we live provincially just the way we always have, or do we live as world citizens who care about the rest of the world as God does? And that's the issue, as I see it.
One question I have, and maybe Jan can help answer that, is that I've made a lot of noise among my friends about Nestle's and refused to eat their chocolate chip cookies and things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And asked them please to, you know, write to the Nestle Corporation mm-hmm. and protest it. Mm-hmm. And so on. And their standard reply to me was that we would actually be imposing a hardship on the people who were imposing hardships on other people by cutting out this market, or this is the only source of employment for wherever the chocolate is caught, you know, the cacao's mm-hmm. grown or whatever. How can we sort of avoid that middle ground between the time when we're trying to boycott and, you know, for instance, in California it's rather simple because the farm workers are unionized, and so if you refuse to buy the lettuce, then you know eventually they are going to get more money. But if we refuse to buy, you know, say, coffee or something from South America, are we cutting off the income, pitiful as it may be, altogether? And how can you get around? What do you do in the interim?
Any feeling on that? The same thing applies in our own country. If we decide we're simply not going to buy all these electronic things that we don't need, let's say, you know, the game things, and we sort of, you know, the boycott, this is an unnecessary luxury, it's using up good resources or something like that. Some people are going to be unemployed. There's always going to be a big fuss about who's going to be unemployed. For example, one thing I've heard is the racing cars. You know, that's a big deal. Even President Carter likes racing. Well, if you talk about energy and fuel and stuff like that, is that the best way to burn up gas just so somebody can watch race cars? Well, I think of all the race car drivers who would be unemployed and all the people in connection with that. And here is where the long-range view has to come in, and how you get to that politically. Now, that's where your central authority, I guess, comes in there. Somehow or the other, we've got to get to policies of production and consumption that are for the long-range benefit of more. There will always be temporary displacement of people who are unemployed or something. And for the people who are the ones who lose their job because people don't buy this thing or boycott this company, it's rough. So how do you plan that? I don't know. But, I mean, that's one of the issues, so you put your finger on it.
It wouldn't happen in a capitalistic system, that's for sure.
Yeah.
If we were to, somebody made an estimate, and I couldn't really back this up with other than the original source. If we gave up all of the things that somebody had determined were not essential
yeah.
for our survival, you're talking about increasing the unemployment rate from 5-6% to something approaching 25-35% in this country. You know, if you use some people's definition of non-essentials. And that's worse than the unemployment rate that we experienced during the depth of the Depression. But that could be a short-term problem. But that's also what I have some problems with. We've almost created a system which needs to continue because the short-term turmoil and the short-term suffering that we can cause by everybody, which I know won't happen anyway, so I really don't have to worry.
But like my student told me, hey, you're hurting the economy if you say don't buy, you know. Downright unpatriotic, you know, to keep from buying all the stuff that you're supposed to buy.
Yeah, and there's no way that the government can keep chipping in, you see, because the government relies on tax revenue, which depends on job income.
Seems to me the hope that you might generate from this kind of a discussion is that people are becoming informed. And if people are informed, then there are ways in which you can act to do something about it. And although you maybe think you can't, the strongest vote you have is exactly from your pocketbook. It's how you spend your dollars. And you have control of that. And you have to make a judgment as to whether it's good to spend it for one thing or for the other. And you have only so many of them to spend, but if you are informed, and it seems to me this is where the church really has fallen short. Our people really are not engaged in an educational program in most congregations. The education stops at the confirmation level, and we're not educating adults, except what can be done for the pulpit. And this is limited, and I think much too limited. And I really feel that the church must get much more involved in educating its constituency about the world, about these situations you've been discussing, and then we have ways of dealing with it.
This book has been used in my congregation by an adult study group, led by an economist, Frank. In terms of very exciting discussions.
There's another one, Schumacher's Small is Beautiful.
Yes.
But
that deals more with the policies, of course, on a larger scale, when industries are appropriate, but that, of course, was the thing that kicked it off, yes.
Yeah, I think you can get individual groups that slowly withdraw and so on, but if everything happened, if you advocated everybody, boy, there'd be massive upheaval.
So Rudy's point about adult continuing education in congregations for consciousness raising, I think, is a very important one to take home. And there's no excuse for, well, there's no material, because there is.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely is.
Yeah. I think the other thing to really, within the educational framework is that, is one of listeners' points, and I have those up on on my wall. I think the one that's really important is the one that to enjoy more creative ways. Mm-hmm. That if we just hammer all the time on sacrifice and other people's suffering, I think we really have to recognize that there's a lot of excess baggage that not only isn't needed, but maybe bad for us, and we may really not be enjoying it so much as we think. But just to tell, if we always say, oh, you have only what you need, that would be nothing. That's food and a roof and clothes, I guess, basically. We're always going to have much more than we need, but we should be more in control of what we decide we're going to have on top of the need.
Have you heard the voices of the children, and have you seen how much fun they have?
Right.
With no toys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a ball or something like that. But they're having more fun in this setting, playing creatively without, you know, a lot of money spent on toys.
Yeah.
I mean, just that idea. I'm not against toys, but I'm just saying, you know, that's being creative.
But lavishness can come from something besides products.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of, you know, Lear, the daughters are taking everything from him and saying, but you only need this many retainers. He says, you know, reason not the need, man, you know, poor unencumbered man. You need more than just bare necessity. But it doesn't have to be product, maybe.
Thank you.
We've got to think maybe a little bit selectively about some of these things too, like some items of consumption cause a good deal more damage worldwide than others, and much as I dislike TV games and Betamaxes and things like that and would never own one myself, I don't really see where they cause all that much dislocation of the world economy.
They're non-polluting also, probably.
Consumption and things like that. But there are sure some other things that really are, I think, getting in a very serious state. And of course, the most obvious is oil, where I honestly believe that we are involved in a life and death struggle. The OPEC people, they have all of the aces, as far as I can see. And they are in a position right now where they can just squeeze until they cause the collapse of the Western economies. And the only weapon that we have right now at our disposal that we can use and get immediate results with is conservation. And that, I think, is something that says simpler lifestyle. And yet, at least up to this point, pleas for this from the president and many other leaders have largely fallen on deaf ears. Nationwide. And I don't quite know why, because it seems like there are no particular obscurities to the facts, and everyone agrees that oil is a finite resource, but so it goes with many minerals and things like that, where large-scale consumption on our own part is running up the price worldwide to the point where other countries cannot get in enough foreign exchange to buy even a modest amount of this stuff for cooking fuel or heating up their houses a little bit or something like that. And,
effect of oil prices.
That's a place where simpler lifestyle could produce some very quick and easily observable results in a very short time, and without really causing us to have to sacrifice all that much. After all, a Honda Civic will get you there just as well as a Chrysler.
Feel free to go to dinner. The increasing oil prices hurt the poor countries more than the rich countries. Some of them are just now turning to mechanization, tractors and things like that, and they've just started to mechanize industry or agriculture or something like that, and all of a sudden oil prices go out of sight for them. Just as it's happening. Also, the production of fertilizer. You see, the Green Revolution depends on petroleum products. The whole business,
I think there's some real hopeful signs, Ellen, that I have seen in the short time we've been back in the States. I've talked to two people for whom the oil situation is difficult. One man who has just retired, for him money is no problem, and he had planned a big trip all around the United States with his wife. And he said, I could afford to buy the gasoline, but he said, I wouldn't feel right. Using up that much gasoline for this kind of trip. This would be a man who probably would never have thought of anything along those lines before. And the reason he didn't want to do it was because he felt it would be a wrong use of that resource, which I thought was a real positive sign. A relative of mine who was going to drive to California and back, but he said he can't do it because it cost him $28 to fill up the tank on his Cadillac. And so he won't do that. So whatever the motivation, there is a change in attitude. And he said he's been taking the train a lot and enjoying it. He didn't think he would like trains, but now he's gotten to like them. So I think there's some hopeful signs so far as in the smaller cars. I've noticed that right away. There are lots more of those on the road.
You see a lot in 2 years.
When we in Columbia, you never see any cars bigger than this. Once in a while, some rich person, even a Mercedes, are fairly small by comparison with what people generally drive here. So I've noticed lots more small cars on the road now than even 2 or 3 years ago. So I think that things are beginning to happen all over this country that are going to make, and I don't know whether gradual change, Jen, then wouldn't create the kind of disastrous situation, but maybe if people bought little bitty cars that got maybe someday 50, 80, or 100 miles to the gallon, yeah, and cost more money to produce and lots more technology and so on, maybe that helps to keep on creating employment. Yeah.
Well, it has created some trouble in Detroit, as a matter of fact.
That's because Detroit is, yeah, has been terribly, terribly slow about adjusting to the realities of the world.
Sure.
And yet thinking they could manipulate consumer demand to keep buying the same old thing year after year.
Mm-hmm. Probably some caddy manufacturers' workers were unemployed for a while.
Yeah. And, foreign car sales have risen from 10% of the market 8 years ago to 21 to 22% of the market now. And you finally see a reaction in Detroit. You finally see a reaction, but it's taken that long. An unemployment rate in Detroit is between 8 and 14%, depending on Detroit and the suburbs and so on.
And there's
so
talk
there
about
been, yeah. There's been some reason.
And isn't Chrysler in trouble because Chrysler has always produced bigger ones? There's a talk of a Chrysler VW merger.
Chrysler Fiat. I didn't know Chrysler was.
But I mean, the fact that they're in trouble because they're identified with bigger cars, you know, it's saying something. There's a response. Yeah,
that would then destroy some of the competition that exists and create more monopolistic types of competitive structures.
I think a lot of the problem we have today, and I learned this from Gay Carford, maybe a friend of mine, a friend of Evelyn's who works in Columbia with him, is that traditionally many churches, and we're one of them, many churches have not had an emphasis on the first article of the creed, on creation and our responsibility and our connection with it and so on. Certainly the kinds of you all would be just sickened to see what goes on in the majority of Latin America. People throw things on the street quite regularly without thinking twice about them. There's a great deal of waste. There's no concern whatsoever for the environment. Rivers are all polluted. The cities are all filled with pollution. I mean, there is no concern for the earth, for our surroundings. Trees are seen as things to cut down, etc. A river is where you dump your sewage. All of this kind of thing in the Catholic Church has been very strong in Latin America for 500 years. So I think it's a real indictment of the Christian community that, mm-hmm, that we have not been people of the first article. We have not seen the importance of God's creation and how we are really a part of it. Mm-hmm. So as we go along, we had a retreat this past year and one of the days we spent was on creation. And so Gay organized several activities, one of which was a simple old Bible camp thing that we've probably all done, where you go around and pick up everything and you make a big line of people and you just walk along and pick every little thing up that doesn't belong there. And 2 or 3 months later, in talking with some of the young people who had been at camp, I asked them what they remembered from the camp, because there were some really tremendous things that happened, acts of reconciliation and so on. And everybody remembered that. They said, gee, I've never felt like the creation was so important, and now I don't do things that I used to do. I put my candy wrappers in my pocket and stuff. So it's amazing how quickly this kind of thing can happen when there are only people who will, mm-hmm, take the time and trouble to teach, mm-hmm, people.
Mm-hmm.